This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Who is at the heart of every climate change debate, championing both science and solutions? It is Dr. Joseph J. Rome. He was acting Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Department of Energy during the Clinton administration, with a specialty in clean energy. His blog, climateprogress.org, is consistently named in the top 25 best climate sources on the net. Joe is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and the author of two books, Hell and High Water in 2006 and Straight Up in 2010. I'm Alex Smith. I'm so pleased Joe Rome is back for his third appearance on Radio EcoShock. When Joe wrote his book, Hell and High Water, after the terrible tragedy of Hurricane Katrina in 2005, direct impact seemed decades away, even slated for the end of this century. But the American South and Midwest got hell and high water already in 2011. It feels like climate change is coming much faster than even the experts expected. We'll be talking later with Dr. Michael Flanagan about early fires in the Canadian North, but I started out asking Joe, what about the hell-like weather that has been happening in Texas this year?
You're seeing this incredible drought and wildfire, you know, a couple of states away from the worst flooding in the history of the Mississippi, in many parts of the Mississippi, and of course these terrible downpours and superstorms. So you are seeing, you know, right here in the United States, as you say, and as I called the book, hellish conditions right next to the high water conditions.
And that's strange, because, and I talked a little bit with Jeff Masters about this, how you could have a drought and fires going on in Texas, and right next door in Louisiana, they have to open the floodgates because there's just so much water.
Yeah, well, I've often said that the basic thing that global warming does is make dry areas drier and wet areas wetter. And it accelerates the water cycle. I'm sure he probably talked about that. I mean, obviously, when you're in a relatively arid part of the country, like, say, West Texas, making things hotter is going to evaporate more moisture, the soil's going to dry up, and of course, heat in general makes any drought much worse. At the same time, that water vapor that you're evaporating has got to go somewhere, and it typically now we see it's coming down in these staggering events where you see like a foot of water in one day or in one or two days, these intense deluges that have just been causing these staggering flash floods that people may have seen videos of what happened in Australia, where it looks like it's an inland tsunami. The water just comes down so fast. And, you know, it hasn't gotten a lot of attention, but Colombia down in South America has been seeing like 11 months of almost nonstop rain. The president of Colombia said they've never seen anything like it before, and it's kind of sad. Normally it would be getting a fair amount of news, but, you know, we've got these devastating floods and superstorms and wildfires and droughts here in the United States, so there's just only so much the U.S. media is going to cover on a story like that.
I know that we're just missing big stories in other parts of the world because there's so much happening at home, and then we had the whole Fukushima disaster in Japan. We might bring that up in a minute. But first, getting back to Texas, it is a big breadbasket. Some of my carrots come from Texas in the wintertime as well. It's a food-producing state. And I noticed that you have a new intern on your site at climateprogress.org who is talking right off the bat about food supplies and possible food shortages. Who did you pick, and what is he talking about?
A guy named Tice Herman. He is a senior at Stetson University down in Florida, and I've been trying to write about food insecurity because I think that, I mean, extreme weather, obviously we all see extreme weather and we all feel extreme weather, but the agricultural system of the planet was designed around a fairly stable climate over the last 10,000 years, and instability in the weather is going to affect crop yields, and we saw last year the devastating droughts and wildfires in Russia has caused them to ban grain exports for a full year, and food prices have shot through the roof, and food prices are one of the reasons why we had the riots in North Africa and the Middle East. So this is all connected, and as we see these extreme events, they disrupt agricultural yields, and there's no question that the storms we're seeing now are being devastating to Texas, which, as you say, does produce a great many crops. You know, China is suffering a devastating drought, which is affecting their crops. France is experiencing a devastating drought that's affecting their crops. And then, of course, the flooding in the Mississippi. They had to flood hundreds of thousands of acres of farmland in order to protect the populations that, frankly, live in flood zones. So, yeah, we're going to see, I think, potentially another rough year for agriculture, and I expect food prices are going to stay near record levels for most of the year.
Right, and that moves right out into the economy. I just saw figures from the U.S. government saying that if you count only energy and food, inflation in 2010 was 19%. And considering most of us are getting, you know, 1 or 2% in our savings accounts, it's just going to hit consumers over the head and reduce our economy. And a lot of that has climate back at its roots.
Well, yeah, and imagine, and we're a rich country. You know, food, wheat prices are literally just a few pennies in a loaf of bread. But you go to a place like Egypt, where they're paying like 40% of their budget is going to food. In the poor countries, you know, when you see record high food prices, that is eating straight out of a large portion of a relatively low income and forcing very tough choices for households. So, yeah, I mean, I think that when food and energy inflation starts to get noticeable in rich countries, you can be sure that it is devastating in poor countries.
Well, I don't know exactly where that's going. It seems like these events that may be partly climate-driven are coming so fast that the new normal is really abnormal, and we can't seem to grasp it, understand it, much less report about it all. Are you feeling that kind of stress just trying to keep up?
Well, yeah. I mean, I started Climate Progress by myself, the Center for American Progress, just me blogging now. I have Stephen Lacey helping me post on clean energy, and now we have this intern. So there is too much to keep up. I think that people need to, you know, try to understand this issue because it is going to affect everyone's lives and be the most important thing in the lives of our children and grandchildren. So and affect decisions about, you know, do you buy coastal property? Do you live in the Southwest, which is going to become a dust bowl? I mean, I think it is important for people to understand the facts, even if, I mean, obviously, I hope that the understanding of the facts will lead people to aggressively want to reduce fossil fuel combustion and heat-trapping emissions of greenhouse gases. But people need to know the truth just because it's going to affect decisions that they make in the course of the next years and decades.
Well, yes, some people are just not going to move back to the flooded out plains after maybe the third time losing their house, and they may move away from areas where they think storms are going to come. So parts of the U.S. may depopulate as people seek safety.
Well, I think there's no question that very hard choices will be made. I you know, the word I often use is triage. People use the word adaptation, you know, to create this impression that humans are very adaptable. Well, humans are very adaptable, but one way we adapt is simply by abandoning things that are no longer viable. And, you know, a vast amount of the population of this country moved to the South and the Southwest, Florida and the Southwest. And by the 2030s, the 2040s, there's no question that that trend is going to reverse. As people come to realize just how hot and arid the Southwest is going to be and how hot and flooded, you know, Florida is going to be, I think people are going to, you know, rethink that. And as you say, people can, one storm, that's not going to change people. But as you start to see these 100-year storms every few years, then people are going to catch on.
This is Radio EcoShock talking with Joe Rome. And Joe, you are also a physicist by training. Given what happened in Japan, where do you personally stand on the role of nuclear power as a way to reduce our greenhouse gases?
Well, you know, I've written a great deal about nuclear power. And, you know, the first thing that must be said is avoiding catastrophic global warming, that is the single greatest challenge for the human race. So we need to keep as many options open as possible for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Nuclear power certainly is one of those options. At the same time, nuclear power has become exceptionally expensive. And I did a post on Climate Progress, which based on a study that was done last year, which showed that over the last two or three decades, the price of new power plants has actually kept going up. you know, most new technologies have a learning curve where they come down in price, like solar power has come down in price dramatically over the last two or three decades, and wind power has come down. But nuclear power has gone up in price, and it is so expensive that nobody in, you know, you could virtually impossible to find a major utility in this country that is willing to purchase a new nuclear power plant just on economic grounds. You know, in the United States, we've put in all these amazing subsidies where the U.S. taxpayer is completely on the hook if there is a major nuclear accident. That's the Price-Anderson Act. At the same time, in the last few years, we've put in place these loan guarantees where new power plants, 80% of the cost of a new power plant is guaranteed by these taxpayer loans. So, you know, with all this, the American taxpayers are covering the risk, the financial risk, and the disaster risk. And even so, it is virtually impossible to find a utility that is willing to spend what has now become $8 or $10 billion for a new nuclear power plant.
I'm kind of laughing because it sounds a little bit like nuclear socialism to me, and nobody likes that word socialism. Well, look, I'd like to move on to some of the new climate research. I was really impressed with a study just published in PNAS, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. The title was Impacts of a Recent Storm Surge on the Arctic Delta Ecosystem Examined in the Context of the Last Millennium. That doesn't sound exciting, but it was a bit frightening to me. Can you explain why an obscure Arctic event matters to the rest of us?
Yeah, this was actually, I hadn't even really ever heard of this storm. We here in the United States often don't hear about things that happen in Canada. I have tried to report on these. But yeah, there was a study that was done at the Queen's University which looked at this 1999 storm, and it showed that it was the worst storm of its kind in a 1,000-year history of this lake ecosystem. And it had, even 10 years later, this lake had not recovered, and large tracts of land near this lake had been permanently changed. And the point of this study was just to say that all those people out there saying, well, you know, what we're seeing now is just stuff we've seen before, all I'll say is in the last two or three decades, the extreme climate that we've been pushing with climate change and greenhouse gases is now moving us into a realm of extreme events that really are unprecedented. I mean, these are once in a 1,000-year events, and the Arctic is especially vulnerable, as you know, and as the ice retreats, it is dramatically changing the entire ecological system of the Arctic, and the peoples who live up there, you know, fully understand that the way of life is being forever changed.
Well, sure, this happened back in 1999, and it was the Aboriginal people, the Inuit, who alerted scientists to it, and they came and they had a really good setup to study what would happen if you got a similar salt surge, let's call it, hitting Chesapeake Bay or around San Francisco, which should possibly happen as the sea is rising. And we're picturing the ocean rising gently year by year, a little millimeter here and there. But in fact, a sea surge like this can change that coastal biology and maybe even the economy in just one big event. Are we really ready for this?
Well, I think that is the key point. I mean, you know, the coastlines of the world, they've been toughened up by storm surges over many years. But as when the sea level rises even 1 or 2 feet, now the ocean is hitting parts of the land that have, you know, are not used to the severe storm. So when the severe storm comes, you're talking about, yes, a devastating storm surge. And you know, this is precisely what we're going to see, because, of course, the storms themselves are getting more extreme. And you're seeing violent storms that are the equivalent of hurricanes occurring in the Midwest. We had a devastating storm that was sort of the equivalent of a hurricane. So, yeah, I mean, I think you're going to see the combination of sea level rise and these superstorms, I think, are going to be very devastating on coastal areas.
Our guest, Joe Rome, is with the Center for American Progress. On the political front, while the U.S. Congress, Joe, is floundering in climate science denial, I see in your blog the Australian Climate Commission has just come out with a report saying warming is real and the country needs to get ready. They don't leave much doubt about it. What did you have to say about that in your blog?
Yeah, that was a very good report. I mean, you know, scientists, and I am, you know, I have a PhD in physics, and I report a great deal on scientists. They tend to, you know, couch their language a lot, and so when scientists speak bluntly, people ought to be worried, because it takes a lot to get scientists to be that concerned that they're willing to just be very straightforward. So this Australian Climate Commission just had a very good report. In fact, they titled it The Critical Decade, and they basically said that either we take strong action now, you know, or, quote, the global climate may be so irreversibly altered we will struggle to maintain our present way of life. And we are talking about potential warming this century of 5 or 6 degrees centigrade, I mean 10 degrees Fahrenheit, creating an utterly different planet in many respects. And the report was just blunt. You know, there's no doubt the climate is changing. Evidence is overwhelming and clear. They use the phrase we use in America a lot. You know, we know beyond reasonable doubt that human emissions of greenhouse gases are the primary cause. So, you know, if this were a criminal case and you were looking for the criminal who's causing the climate change, it's us. You know, we're the ones who are creating the change. We're the perpetrators. And so it's a very good report. It also spends a lot of time talking about the strategy needed to reduce emissions, and I commend that to people. Obviously, Australia is going through a lot of political turmoil itself over the carbon tax and how it's going to reduce its emissions. And, you know, it's been frustrating that there's been this massive disinformation campaign, which I think has greatly muddied the waters about what stuff that is relatively obvious, which is our urgent need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
Yes, and we need the Australians to stop expanding the railways that carry the coal out for export to China and many other countries. That's helping global warming as well.
Well, look, every country's doing it. You got Canada with the tar sands. You know, we have the United States with its large use of coal and oil. China is obviously been building coal plants at a rapid rate. It is a problem where all the nations have to come together and solve this problem the way that we save the ozone layer and, you know, basically, you know, shut down production of most chlorofluorocarbons. And that was a nick of time thing. I mean, people don't remember that ozone hole opened up, and that really sobered people up and got them to finally agree to relatively strong, you know, ozone-destroying substances constraints. So we need adults. I mean, we need some adults to step in and say everybody's got to take action.
Well, then I have to ask, Joe Rome, are we really making any climate progress at all? I mean, let's talk some good news stories, the solutions that could get us out of this energy mess without collapsing civilization, please. Could you talk to us about geothermal maybe, or solar and wind? Where's the progress?
Well, you know, look, the clean energy technologies are ready. They're raring to go. I had a long talk with Robert Sokolow of Princeton University, who developed this approach called the wedges, where you look at the technologies needed to address climate change. And he remains as even more of a believer today than when he wrote the article 5 or 6 years ago, that we have the technologies needed today to aggressively deploy clean energy cost effectively and reverse our emissions trends. And yeah, we're talking solar power, which has come down in price by, you know, a factor of 20 in the past 30 years, the solar photovoltaic. We're talking about new forms of solar, which include, you know, where you have the mirrors, concentrated solar thermal in the desert. You reflect the mirrors onto tubes of liquids that you heat up to boiling. Wind power obviously has become the biggest form of new renewable. And you have geothermal, where you use the Earth's heat, and there's a lot of new technologies. We just did a post on sort of 5 hot new geothermal companies and their technologies. And energy efficiency. I mean, I do not want to, you know, forget to mention energy efficiency. Whether it's LED lighting or smart controls or better heating and cooling systems. Their opportunities just to cut people's energy bills and save energy, you know, remain very large. So we don't have to go to zero emissions tomorrow, but we have to get off of our emissions path as soon as possible. And the technologies, there is absolutely no question that they exist and that they're ready to go when governments get serious about them.
So we could do it. Can you name any countries that have actually reduced their greenhouse gas emissions, really?
sure. Many countries in Europe have. Germany has, and Great Britain has. In fact, Great Britain has just a week or two ago, the climate secretary said that Great Britain will cut its greenhouse gas emissions to 50% below 1990 levels by within about 15 years, continuing their reductions of the last decade or so. And, you know, we've seen countries like Denmark who've been aggressively deploying, you know, renewables. And these are remarkable achievements, given that the United States has refused to go along on a global deal, and yet other countries have realized that these technologies are the future, and whichever country leads the way in reducing the greenhouse gas emissions and deploying clean energy technologies, they're going to be the leader in these job-creating industries of the future.
As we head towards wrap-up, is there anything else you'd like to add that our listeners should hear about?
Everyone, I think, needs to become informed on this issue. I speak at college campuses and tell these are the jobs of the future, these skill sets. I tell young people, I mean, you know, I usually start by apologizing for our generation not acting swiftly enough to reduce emissions. But these are the jobs that surround giving people food, a sustainable agricultural system, dealing with water, water efficiency, clean energy, low carbon energy, understanding the climate system. You know, these are going to be some of the most important jobs of the future, and I think everyone needs to understand what's happening, and young people should see how they can contribute.
Well, listeners, as you've seen, Joe Rome has been an expert on major television networks, and he can get big radio coverage almost any time, but he still takes the time to speak to college audiences and community activists, and we really appreciate that about you, Joe Rome. Thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.